All right, I'm now going to introduce the speaker, and please give him an applause. John S.
Hey, everybody, I'm John Charles. I'm an alcoholic. Man, there's a lot of good-looking alcoholics out there, man. This AA thing works. I don't even see anybody cockeyed. It really works. Man, I just want to tell y'all, first of all, thank you for your invitation and thank you for having this thing. My sobriety date is March 7th, 1989. I have 30 years sober. And I have been going to things like this from the first year. I mean, I have been going to conferences and roundups and workshops and international conventions and state conventions and regional forums and just different things in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when we get together, it's where the magic really happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if every one of us just had a big book and just stayed home and just read it and tried to work the steps on our own, no. We wouldn't have this big society that we have worldwide, millions and millions of members. Something is amazing about this deal, and it's worthwhile to get together and celebrate it. So it's great that y'all are doing this, and I'm really glad to be included in it. I told you my sobriety date. My home group is a Fifth Tradition group. It is the best group in Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. And I was told if you don't feel that way about your home group, then you probably need to change your home group. That's right, baby. So, but we meet on Thursday nights. We have a closed big book study. And on Saturday nights, we have an open speaker meeting. And it's Northeast Atlanta and Chamblee area off of Embry Hills United Methodist Church. And it's a Fifth Tradition group. And you can look us up. We're in the schedule. And we'd love for you to come by and see us sometime. And this is, you know, if you stick around this deal for long enough, you will get asked to talk a fair amount. And this may be one of the most dangerous things that you eventually get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you can start to believe that you're something hot. Because people want to hear you talk. I mean, alcoholics love to talk anyway, you know. And there's a certain kind of alcoholic that will never shut up. And, you know, until they're underneath a tombstone. We see that a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't we? But it's dangerous because let me tell you who your speaker is tonight. Your speaker is a self-centered scumbag. Okay? I'm telling you, you know, you're seeing the finished product. That might not be readily apparent that I'm a self-centered scumbag. But I want you to know that I am. And I want you to know that the thing that I want more than anything else is for everyone to like me. Just that simple little thing. I just want everyone to like me. And if someone doesn't like me, it really bothers me. It bothers me so much that I might need to drink about it. And so the ego, which I have come to understand is a central part of my alcoholic illness. And we were talking about this morning, and several of us were sitting around a table talking about it. It comes and goes, and it comes and goes. And I worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it goes down enough that the spirit can shine through and I can have some recovery take place. You know, and then the gifts of sobriety come back, and I start thinking it's all me, and I start thinking I'm hot shit, and I start thinking I'm doing great again, and the ego comes back up again. It blocks the sunlight of the spirit off again, and I'm miserable again, and I go down again, and I get, you know, wretched, and I hate everybody, and it's all their fault again, and, you know, and then I got to do some more step work again, and I got to have a new spiritual experience again. And that's been the whole cycle of my sobriety. And I'll just tell you, so our book tells us how to do this in a general way. It says we tell our story, we tell what we used to be like, what happened to us, and then what we're like, you know, now. And so if I do that tonight and you hate it, there'll be another speaker here pretty soon, you know. So just know that, you know. I was born in summer of 1969, and I was born to a good family. My folks were smart people. They're educated people. They were loving and I mean interesting people. They're dynamic and wonderful. Wow, there's a fair amount of alcoholism in the family. I have 7 brothers and sisters that I am supposed to know about. I have a few other brothers and sisters that I'm not supposed to know about. I have about half of us are alcoholics at any given moment, it seems like. Come from a long line of alcoholics on both sides of the family, and but they're also incredibly entertaining and loving bunch, you know. My family's not the kind of, you know, get in a knockdown, drag out fight and bust your teeth out alcoholics. They're more like the, you know, get drunk and do something embarrassing, take their clothes off and everybody laughs alcoholics, you know. That's just sort of where I come from, you know. And I grew up in a home. Here, let me just say this real quick. We put an awful lot, most of us when we get here, and I'm no different, you know, put an awful lot of stock in the childhood. You know, and my childhood was like such and such, and I think for most of us, for certain me, I thought because my childhood was a certain way, there's no hope for me, and I'm an alcoholic, and, you know, and I had all kind of diagnoses, and I had all kinds of, you know, my family had some money, and when you're a screw-up from a family with some money, you get to see an awful lot of doctors. And psychiatrists and psychologists, and I've seen them all. And got a lot of different ideas about what's wrong with John. And but what I realize now is what's wrong with John is what I said right at the beginning. I'm self-centered. I am so self-centered. I am just hardwired to think about me and to think about money and to think about what makes John happy and to think about sex and think about anything and everything that makes John happy. You know, and I don't even notice y'all for the most part. I'm like that. I just don't care. You know, I just don't care. You know, it's like I'm on a stage and there's a spotlight on me and it's my show and everybody else is just shadowy, you know, extras, you know, in the play with my life. And, you know, it's, and I mean, and to some extent, that's true of a lot of people. We don't have a corner on that market exactly, okay, in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I do think, like the book says, that we're extreme examples of self-will. We're not just self-will run riot. We're extreme examples. And I've had the great benefit of getting to bring three children into the world and watch them. And you know what I've learned watching my children? Is I'm just a gigantic baby that never wanted to grow up. Man, that's one of the fun. I'm just a big kid. Because, boy, kids are mine! Mine, mine! He took me, touched it, he took it! You know, I mean, with just a slightly different language. I mean, that's how I've been talking all my life. You know, really, it's an oddball thing. But I grew up in this family, and you know, like I said, it was an alcoholic family, but it's a very loving family. And my mother was maybe the most loving person. I really mean that, about the most loving person you can ever imagine. She had such a lousy childhood, just filled with abuse and sexual abuse and just depredations. And she was so determined that her children were going to have better. And she spoiled the hell out of us. And, I mean, we had, and when I say this, I mean, I really mean it. My mom sat around all day and thought, how am I going to spend my money on my kids? I swear to God, that's what she did. My mom came up with, she was a nurse and she was an Al-Anon. And I wish she'd have stayed now. Where are my Al-Anons at? Okay, we got lots of Al-Anons here. Good. I love seeing... No, seriously. I love seeing AA and Al-Anon together because that's how we're supposed to be. Okay? And I want to tell you my cautionary tale, Al-Anons. My mother went to Al-Anon long enough for her three children to get into Alcoholics Anonymous, and then she quit going, remarried the drunk that she had kicked out, and died under that drunk's thumb. You know, years later. And it was ugly, slow, painful Al-Anon death. Alcoholics aren't the only ones who die an ugly, slow death. You know, a lot of times the Al-Anons do, too. Anyhow, just a cautionary tale. You stick with your Al-Anon, ladies and gentlemen. But anyhow, my mom was, she built a fire pole. My mom had three little boys, myself, my two younger brothers. She built a fire pole in our house just because she thought it would be cool for her kids. Isn't that something? We had a fire pole installed, a big old 4-inch chromium pole, man, went right from the top of the stairs down to the kitchen. Had a little gate around it. And when it was installed, I was about 10 years old, every kid in a 16-block radius came to our house, ran up our stairs, jumped on the pole, slid down to the kitchen, ran down the hall, ran up the stairs, jumped on the pole, slid down to the kitchen all day and all night for like months. And that was my house was the house that you came to play at because my mom wanted, you know, she was a little bit lit. She wanted us to be at the house. You know, because she had had all those experiences that she'd had as a child. She wanted to make sure we were looked after and we were taken care of and given things to do. She had a half pipe built. Any skateboarders in here? Any ex-skateboarder types in here? Got a few, okay. Half pipe in the backyard. I'm talking 40-foot long, 16-foot wide, 10-foot high, 25 kids skating up and down on that ramp all the damn time until the insurance company learned about it and then they made us... Man, just give it up. I went to a great school. I was raised in the 70s. I was joking about this earlier. We were free range children back in the 70s. It was like they turned you loose when the sun came up, and then it said, "Be home by lights out for dinner." And if you go anywhere but so and so's house, you call and tell me. And that was it. You know, we were out of the house 10, 12 hours a day. And I went to school at a little school about two blocks from where I lived. We walked to and from school every day. It was a private school. It was a very, very well-respected school. It was a religious school. I was raised in the church. I went to church every single Sunday. I went to the youth group. I sang in the choir. I was a soloist. I was reconfirmed. I was in Sunday school and big church and small church and church, you know. And it wasn't a heavy, I was raised Presbyterian, which anyone will tell you, that ain't a real heavy religion. You know, I went to a Greek Orthodox of all things, Greek Orthodox on Sundays, which is a little more Eastern Orthodox church, you know. It was very confusing. I went to Eastern Orthodox religious day school every day of the week. We had little mini mass every day, so I don't know what was going on. But, I joke about the Presbyterians. I say, I was raised Presbyterian, but I believe in God anyway. But I came up in the church, and about the age of 13... it just all crystallized in my head that this is just all BS. You know, there ain't no God. Or if there is one, it ain't what they're talking about. And let me back up for just a second. One of the fundamental things about me is I have never fit anywhere. Okay? I just never have. I know that's a common story in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was raised in the church, but I didn't really fit in the church. I didn't fit with the nice church kids. I was mischievous and devious. From the very youngest age, I was shoplifting at the age of 5. You know, M&M's. M&M's. You know? I started cultivating an honest look, seriously, at the age of 5 or 6. My old man, he caught me. I would steal, he had a big old beer stein on his dresser for his loose change. And he would throw that loose change in there every day, and I would steal it. 5 or 6 now, free-range children. Go down to the 7-Eleven, and I would buy candy for all my friends. I was like a big spender, even at 5 or 6 or 7, you know? And one day he caught me, 5 or 6 years old, had my hand in the money jar, stealing the money. "What are you doing?" "I'm just counting this money." Like, I was able to lie at the age of 6, you know. "Oh, okay, he's just counting the money." Okay, I had that devious thing. I had that mischievous thing from the youngest age. And I never fit in anywhere. I was good at sports when I was a kid. I played football and baseball. I was good at those sports. But I didn't fit with the jocks. Okay? I was smart, and I was capable of, like, just learning quickly. And if I could sit in a class and listen to it, and I wasn't distracted, which wasn't that often, but I could make an A on your test, but I wasn't going to do your homework. I was defiant from about the 3rd grade. "I have to be here, lady. I have to be here from 7 till 3. I am not taking these books home. I am not doing assignments outside of here. I am required by law to be here, and that is it. And after that, it's not my problem." And so I started making terrible grades at a young age. I didn't fit in school. I was defiant and mischievous and devious. And I didn't really fit in my family. I didn't fit anywhere. And I don't think I even realized that until the first night I drank at the age of 13. I come from a big drinking family, so I'd had sips off the old man's beer, and I'd had, you know, a sip of wine at Christmas dinner, and blah, 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 and all that kind of stuff. But I'm talking about the first time that I drank enough to feel it. I was 13 years old, went out with some of the older kids in the neighborhood. I was terrified to go out with them because I was the youngest one in the little group, and the oldest one had a car, so he was at least 16. And I wanted to be included. You know, but I was terrified that I was going to make a fool of myself. But I went out with these older boys, and we got 8 quarts of Mickey's Mean Green Malt Liquor. Oh, and it was on. By the time I got through about half, 3/4 of that first quart, I was 13 years old, so I'm maybe 125 pounds. By the time I got half a quart of liquor in me, malt liquor in me, man, I was a totally... It says in our big book, right, that in our 12th step, right? Having had a spiritual experience as awakening as a result of this. I had a spiritual awakening as a result of half a quart of Mickey's Mean Green Malt Liquor. And it was nothing short. It was a spiritual experience. I was instantly transformed to someone who had who was careworn and stressed out and anxious and unhappy and unable to communicate with his people around him, to someone who was completely connected. There was no separation between me and you. I was so glad to be in your company. And let me tell you about John Shires. And just this personality bubbled out of me that I hadn't ever had before, because I was a very awkward and shy person by nature. And it was the greatest thing. I didn't realize it was just like I'd been carrying around a 50-pound burlap sack full of stones, and I just set them down for the first time ever. That's the experience that I had. You know, which I have a unique relationship with alcohol as an alcoholic. That's one of the things that I came to learn about this whole deal. So, anyway, I drank that night. I got completely drunk on 2 quarts of malt liquor. We went to the movie theater, and we were watching a movie. It was some Eddie Murphy movie. And the last thing I remember is thinking it would be really hysterical to urinate in the movie theater. And leaning way back in my chair and just an arc of pee going up over the top and just laughing and peeing hysterically. I thought that was, and my friends and I thought that was so funny until we were all forced to make a hasty exit from the movie theater. And that was a kind of a pattern right there that was going to be established. And like I said, insane alcoholic scumbag. And the next morning, we were all in a lot of trouble. I had thrown up all over my friend's parents' place. Everybody was caught in the act of our big outing, you know, drinking and getting in trouble and whatever. Everyone was in trouble because of me. Another pattern that was going to keep going over the year. And the next day, I was hungover. I was as grounded as a 13-year-old could be. Had every possible privilege taken away. And the thing that I remember most, though, about that was the next morning going, that was the greatest night of my life. That was absolutely great. And when are we going to do that again? And all of those consequences, man, that is really, if you think about it, it's not that big a price to pay. You know, that's a reasonable exchange for me for what it gave me. That is the power of what alcohol does for me. It is such a powerful thing. And I would go on to trade, you know, what it did for me for basically everything good in my life over the next 6 years. But I was a 13-year-old kid, and, you know, you can't get into that much trouble as a 13-year-old kid. We would drink on weekends. I lived in a neighborhood where there were a lot of liquor cabinets and a lot of my friends' parents' places. There was a liquor cabinet my folks had. And so we started stealing liquor. And, you know, it was the kind of thing, we were pretty subtle about it. You know, we would steal, okay, here's a bottle of vermouth. Okay, there's 1 inch of that. Here's a bottle of cream de menthe. There's 1 inch of that. Here's a bottle of Bacardi rum. 1 inch of that. You know, and just kind of keep pouring it in. So you had this in a jar. You know, just a jar of just rot gut mixed. It was, you know, it wasn't very appetizing. It was cloudy. You know what I'm saying? It was just the nastiest stuff. But we would steal it and have these jars, and we would go out in the little park. It was a park kind of out down the street in front of our house. And we would sit in the bushes, you know, in the park on Friday night, just sit there and just pass this nasty jar of liquor around and just and say stuff like this. Like, man, that's smooth. And so we would do that, and we would all just BS each other about how cool we were and how much fun. And that's how we drank. And there's a lot of potential alkies in that neighborhood. And some of those kids, I have no idea what happened to them. Although some of them, and I'll talk about this later, but some of them actually turned it around later, and they weren't alcoholics. They were just hard drinkers. And our big book makes a distinction about that. And it's a really important distinction that there are people. Actually, one of the guys who drank that stuff with me is my buddy Brian. We're still friends to this day. He got in more trouble. I quit drinking. I got sober at the age of 19, almost 20 years old. Wow. Brian continued for another 20 years, basically drinking like that and getting in trouble and going to jail and having all these different things, the kind of experiences that we have. And then one day he said, you know what, I'm so sick of living this way. I'm going back to school. And he basically quit drinking liquor. You know, he still drinks beer. He still smokes weed. But he just went back to school, and he got himself a job, and he got himself an education, and now he's like a regional manager for this green construction company out of Asheville, North Carolina, and he don't need to do what we have to do. You know what I'm saying? And sometimes we'll look at a guy like that, and we'll try the experiment one more time, but our big book makes it a really clear distinction between the hard drinker and the alcoholic. And the distinction is the hard drinker, when the rubber hits the road and he really needs to quit, he can. And when the rubber hits the road and I really need to quit, I can't. I say, you know what, that's it, I'm done, except for this one. And then it's just all on again. Anyhow, so I grew up and I drank and I started mixing in some drugs and partying and smoking grass and doing all kinds of other things. And it was, you know, this is the mid-80s. And it just became the most important thing in my life. Some people have a long alcoholic history where they drank reasonably controlled for 10 or 20 years and then they kind of tailed into active alcoholism. Man, mine was fast. If you wanted to see my social drinking, you needed to look quickly. Because it was literally like, it was like straight alcoholism almost from the jump, you know. And that's the way I just like it. Oh, yeah, I like to party, you know. And that's just how I felt about it. And anytime, every time, no matter how, we'll get the money. We'll figure out a way to get the money. We do. There's always something to pawn, at the very least. Consequences, like all kinds of consequences. But again, they didn't matter, you know. I got into trouble. I was always into trouble. I got kicked out. So in the ninth grade, I was expelled. So my rich father sent me to Tampa Preparatory School. This is the private college prep school in Tampa, Florida, where I grew up, where all of the rich kids went, like all the doctors' kids and lawyers' kids, and all these kids that were to go on to like choke and, you know, and get Rhodes scholarships and things like that. I mean, that it was one of these schools that really prided itself on its academic excellence. And I was expelled from that school in precisely 5 months, along with all the other alcoholics, because we all went out one day at lunchtime and got hammered. And I don't remember what we did exactly, but we drank a bunch and we popped a few pills. And, you know, one of the lightweight kids kind of threw up and had a seizure. And he narked on everybody else, so we all got kicked out. So I had to go to the regular high school with my regular friends, which is where I wanted to be in the first place, because I didn't like going to that fancy school. So now I'm in regular high school, and it's just on. There's a lot less control there. And so my thing was this. We would get to school early. Me and my five or six degenerate friends, we would pool our resources. You know, someone's got a bottle, and someone's got a few pills, and someone's got a joint. And we would walk down the street to the little wooded area beside the high school there. It was like a golf course down there. There was some woods on the side. And we would all sit in our little hangout, and we would drink and party and do whatever we had and go to school wasted and just think it was hysterical. I remember I had typing first period, like two semesters in a row, and I failed it because the first period was not a good period to type. And that's just how I went through high. I hardly remember high school, honestly. And I didn't finish it. I failed so many classes, you know, you had to go to summer school. And if you fail even more classes than that, you had to go to summer school and summer night school. And you know, my wife always laughs at that because she's like, I didn't even heard of summer night school before I met you. But then eventually, in my second junior year, because I'd failed so many classes, I just quit one day. And my old man, I have a pretty impressive old man, actually. I hate his guts. I can tell you today that he's a pretty impressive person, you know. But I hated his guts. He's a Marine, for one thing, my old man. He's a tough guy, you know. He came from nothing. I mean, he came from nothing. His old man was a terrible alcoholic. And he came from nothing. He went to the Marine Corps 4 years, fought in Korea, you know, GI Bill, college, medical school, started his own company, built this huge company of 600 employees, earned a ton of money, invented stuff. He was a jerk. He didn't treat me right. And I was such an embarrassment to him. I was such an embarrassment. So if I embarrass you and then you yell at me because I'm a scumbag, somehow you're in the wrong. That's the way my life went. Until I did an inventory in Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought my dad was one of the biggest jerk-offs on the planet. Okay, I hated his guts, didn't talk to him for a couple of years. But I went to live with my father because the psychiatrist that my mom had sent me to thought I needed a male role model and that I should move in with my dad. And he also diagnosed me with this crazy condition. And I'm going to talk about this. I was diagnosed with a condition called mixed cerebral dominance. Doesn't that sound hot, though? Doesn't it? It's just Mixed cerebral dominance. That was a killer 1970s, kind of 80s sort of thing. And this is a really rare condition. It's very, very rare. I may be the only person who ever suffers from it. if that's not true. It is an actual viable condition. Most people who have it, it basically means that most people are either right-brained or left-brained. But people have this condition, they're back and forth. They're right brain one day, left brain the next day. And the truth is most people who have that condition are also profoundly dyslexic, which I am not. But it was like without dyslexia. He mixed cerebral dominance without dyslexia. It sounds awesome. It is awesome. I told everyone, here's the thing about alcoholics, about this alcoholic. I've always felt different. I've always felt like I didn't fit nowhere. I've always felt unique and misunderstood. And now there's a reason. Now there's a reason. I have this rare, untreatable, by the way, mental condition. And I would tell anybody and everybody who would listen to me about this rare, untreatable mental condition that I had. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I hugged that diagnosis close to my breast. You know, and I would say, well, I'm going to try your little steps. But, you know, I have mixed cerebral dominance. It's a rare, untreatable mental illness. And the implication was, it's going to be a lot harder for me to get sober in this deal than it is you. But I moved in with my father as a result of that whole deal. And when I got kicked out of high school, my dad did a loving thing that I did not have view as a loving thing at the time. He kicked me out of the house. He said, no long-haired hippie scumbag alcoholic junkie son of mine is going to live here for free. And so I did what every macho man does. What do you do, macho man, when you're down? Go to mama's house! That's right. Yeah, I went to mama's house. I went to my poor Al-Anon mother's house. And I sponged off her for a while, and then she kind of half-helped and half-kicked me out of the house. Like we just did with our 21-year-old. And I ended up in Gainesville, Florida in 1988. And I was 18 going on 19. And this was my last chance. And this was my chance I was going to go to junior college, and I was going to kick ass and take names and prove to everyone that I am not a scumbag, I am not an idiot, and I just don't need your damn high school diploma. I had a GED at this point, which stands for good enough diploma. And I went to this junior college, and I went to Santa Fe Junior College at Higher Learning, Gainesville, Florida. And by the way, Gainesville, Florida is a really horrible place for a budding alcoholic to go. So now I'm living in a little place in Gainesville. I'm working in Gainesville. I'm making enough money and stealing enough money to drink and party the way that I want to with absolutely no oversight from anybody. And it took about a year of that for me to completely and totally hit bottom. And here's what hitting bottom for me looked like. Yours might look different. This is how mine looked like. I ended up in this house on the outskirts of Gainesville, Florida. My roommate and I, my roommate, by the way, dropped out of school in the seventh grade, and I kept him around because it made me feel like a GED was pretty damn good. I mean, we don't even have rednecks. I want y'all to know, we don't even have rednecks in Georgia that hold a candle to the Florida redneck. This kid was, he was just awesome. And anyway, he dropped out in the seventh grade and somehow managed to never, ever go to school again after that. I think he did some reform schools. But anyway, the two of us were living in this house for $450 a month at the outskirts of Gainesville, Florida in 1988. And we were 2 months behind in our $450 a month rent. You know, it was nothing. $450 a month? Can you for a whole house? You know, and we were getting ready to be evicted. Everything had been turned off, and finally the water had been turned off. And you can live without a lot of things. You can live without electricity. Candles, you know, you can deal with candles. It just makes you feel a little bit 18th century, but you know, you can kind of get along with candles. It's sort of romantic and all this kind of stuff. But when there's no water and you can no longer shower or brush your teeth, or most importantly, flush the toilet, because the need to use the toilet still exists when there's no water in your house, but the ability to flush the toilet is gone. And this was the situation we found ourselves in February of 1989, and it was particularly cold. And that year, and we figured out, I'll have you know, that we could, after it got dark, we could steal into the neighbor's yard and take their garden hose and run it through our bathroom window, fill that tank up, and flush that sucker at least once a day. Maybe twice. Now, that's totally insane. Okay? That is unmanageable living. Okay? Here's even more unmanageability for you, though. At the time, I remember putting that hose up through there and thinking, you know, a lot of people wouldn't even be able to handle this. Isn't that crazy? That is some crazy thinking. I'm patting myself on the back like an alcoholic MacGyver, you know, like solving this. Is that a garden hose? I'll show you how to flush this toilet. About that time, my Al-Anon mother, who was actively in Al-Anon at this time, suggested that a trip to the treatment center might be a good idea. And I agreed with her. Not because, and I swear to God, I did not believe, and I can remember as clear as I'm sitting here today, lying on this floor in this scumbag house, just lying on the floor, and there's just empties everywhere. There's like little corners of baggies everywhere. There's trash and just junk, and it was just as dirty as a house could be. And lying on the floor, talking to my mother, and thinking, I know I'm not an alcoholic. I know I'm not a junkie. You know, I party and I drink, yeah, but I'm not. That's not my problem. But maybe I'm crazy. Maybe I really am crazy. And maybe this druggy and alcohol treatment center place can help. So maybe I'll go along and do that. But mostly what I was thinking is, they got running water. Yeah. They got running water and electricity. So I moved into the 20th century treatment center. And, you know, and it was. They did have all those things. And it was the first time I'd been, you know, but when I had 7 days sober, that was the first time I'd had 7 days sober since I started drinking. I mean, that's why I said, my alcoholism was right off the jump. So for basically 6 years, I had not had 7 days in a row. Got in that treatment center. You know, got detoxed and all that kind of stuff. Started going to all the different groups and the therapy things and all the stuff that you do and the music therapy and the basket weaving and the music class and all that stuff. And, and all the counseling and all the stuff. And I thought it was stupid. I thought it was all totally stupid. But they had AA meetings every night. They either brought in an outside speaker every night or they took us down to the next building where they had brought in a meeting and when you got to, I don't know if y'all remember, if y'all were in treatment in the 80s particularly, they'd have these long, because I was in for 4.5 months because my old man's insurance was good, you know. And it's really peculiar how the treatment center pronounces you well on the day your insurance runs out, you know. And so for me, that was 4.5 months. So I got 4.5 months of all the counseling and all the stuff. But there was a level system. You remember that? Like level one, level two, level three, level four. It was so cool. I'm level four. You're only level three. Don't talk to me. You know? But you got to get on the what? And go to the meeting in the white van. Oh, yeah. The white van. And you got to fight for who's going to ride shotgun because they got to control the radio. And started going to meetings. And the miracle happened to me in that little period. In about a month it happened. The first miracle. Is that I heard y'all's stories. I heard you talking about drinking and totally getting insane and not stopping and losing everything and coming in here, and you were laughing about it. And I can remember the first time, I was maybe 2-3 weeks sober, the first time that I just joined in your laughter and just busted a gut and grinned through an entire meeting and had an almost like painful face at the end of the meeting from laughing and crying. And then realizing, God, I have not done that in a long time. Damn little laugh about when you're living out there, is there? And so within about a month, I think, I was like, these are my people. I fell in love with y'all. I fell in love with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a powerful thing. It's an amazing power of attraction, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just jumped in. And I got out of that treatment center, and I went and did halfway house, and I did three-quarter house and 9/16 house, and I did the whole thing. I did the whole series of houses and through my first year. And I went to meetings. I went to meetings every single day. Sometimes I went to more than one a day. You know, because in Atlanta, you know how it is, Metro Atlanta, and there's a 5:45, and then there's an 8 o'clock, and then there's a 10 o'clock, and there might be a midnight meeting. And, you know, and I got a job, and I got back in school, and I started going to junior college again, up at Kennesaw Junior College. That's how old I am. It was still junior college back then. Now it's a big old university, but it was Kennesaw Community College. And everybody in the community can go, all the crackheads and the hookers and, you know, and the high school dropout rednecks from Florida. And so I ended up at Kennesaw, and I started making straight A's up there because now I'm sober. I'm sober. I got a program of action of sorts. Because at that time, as you'll learn, it wasn't that much. I fell in love with the fellowship, you see. And I did what a lot of us have done. A lot of my sponsees do. I fall in love with the fellowship, and I kind of skip out a lot of the other important things. You know, I loved y'all's meetings. I loved y'all's coffee. I came here, and they said, take what you want and leave the rest. And thankfully, they don't say that much anymore, because I don't think that's good advice for alcoholics. If you tell me, take what I want and leave the rest, here's what I'm taking. I'm taking your coffee. I'm taking a girl from your meeting. I'm taking a handout and any free literature you got. And that's what it is. And that's what I did. That's what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came here, really for my first 2 years, I think. I came to 365 meetings a year. I might occasionally have put a dollar in the basket if I had any spare money on me. I think, you know what I think too? I think I went to a lot of meetings in churches, in church halls, you know, with this size, you know, and the chairs were all set out and the coffee was made and everything. And I think I just thought, you know, all these church people just put this out for their part of their Christian duty or something. You know? I never thought that people got there early and made that coffee. People got there early and sat up there in chairs. I told you I'm self-centered as hell, right? You know? I just, of course there's coffee for me. Of course there's a chair for me and their lights are on for me and their bathroom works. You know? I mean, that's just how blind and self-centered I naturally am. You know? So I just came to AA. I went to lots of meetings and I just started trying to get my life back. You know what I'm saying? Like so many of us do. And it was all about work and going to school and getting ahead and doing this and doing that. And my first year of sobriety was amazing. It was amazing. My 1 year anniversary at the little group that I was going to at that time, there was like 100 people there and they all clapped for you and all this kind of stuff. And everybody, I knew 100 people's name and they knew my name. And that was all that mattered. And I'd never had that before. I'd never had 100 people knew my name and I had known 100 people's names. Okay, by the end of the second year, all that newness had sort of worn off. And it was just like, in meetings, you know. But like, it was like in school. I was 2 years sober now. I'd finished an entire year junior college, however many credits that was, 4.0 average. That was the first good thing that I'd ever done in my life. And it felt amazing, you know. Had a job, had some money, had my parents. I went from an alcoholic scumbag junkie to a parent's wet dream. Okay? In 1 year. My parents were so happy because I was killing myself and never thought about how they felt about that forever. Never thought once about how they felt about it. And suddenly I'm sober and I'm going to school. And they're not even having to tell me to do these things. I'm just doing them. And they're like, God, John, we're so happy. I had a great relationship with my parents, or a reasonably good one, not a great one, because I hadn't worked any steps, I hadn't made any amends yet, and they were still really skeptical. And that pissed me off, you know. Look at me, I'm sober, I cut my hair, and I'm going to school and making straight A's, you know. Jerks. And so, 2 years go by. I'm not doing so well on the inside, okay? I'm just not doing so well on the inside, you know? And halfway through that second year, I was really doing badly. I was still going to 7 meetings a week. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I go to a lot. Even today, I go to a lot. My home group meets twice a week, and I usually go to at least one more. So I'm at 3 or 4 AA meetings a week. And service stuff, I'm involved in a lot of service stuff, jails and prisons and stuff like that. And I love being involved in all that. But in and of itself, the meetings are not the program. The program, I don't think I've ever worked a single step in a meeting. I might have made some amends to people at meetings, you know, because I've done a lot of boneheaded things, said a lot of boneheaded things to people at meetings that later required me to go back to the meeting and apologize and say, how can I make this right? But I don't think, otherwise than that, I don't think I've ever worked any steps in the meeting except for the coming to believe part. And I mean, I've had to sit down with my sponsors and go through this book and write out that inventory and get clear on my character defects and get God involved and then go make amends and then try to help somebody. And most of that I have not done within the confines of the meetings. I've learned about people's experience with it and been able to take some of that away. But I basically, I hadn't learned any of that. I heard one of the greatest things I ever heard. Anyone go to the 2015 International Convention down the road here? Okay, a bunch of y'all went. Yeah, wasn't that amazing? And I had the speaker from Australia. He said he did. He put it perfectly. He said, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years and I couldn't stay sober, and I did every single thing that you guys told me to do except for 12 things. And that was exactly what I did. I came to 365 meetings a year and I never got a sponsor and never worked any steps. Those are two fairly key elements of this deal. I just want to, for the newer people. So anyway, about 2.5 years sober, I almost got drunk and I was suicidally depressed. I was ready to put a gun in my mouth at 2.5 years sober. But I would come to meetings and act like everything was great. And there's a real disconnect between a guy who's just BSing, oh man, you know, I would share in meetings and people would come up to me, my wife and I laugh about all this because she has the same ego problem that I have. I would share in meetings and people would come up to me after the meeting and say, man, what you said was right on, dude. That meant something to me. I really appreciate it, man. You really touched me. And I'd say, brother, you just keep going. This thing will work for you too. And I'd go home and contemplate blowing my brains out for the rest of the night. Because the need to look like I have my shit together is more important than actually having it together. You know? That's a crazy, insane place to be. So I almost drank. And it was a grace of God thing that I didn't drink. I went to a party I had no business being at. You know, and on the outside, my life looks great. I'm going to Emory University now. I'm in a regular, like, college student, and I make good grades, and my parents love me, and I've got money, and I've got a car, and I got a nice apartment in like, the Virginia Highlands area of town where all the cool kids go, you know. And I almost drank, and I went back to my home group at that time was the Skyland group, or the group that was to become my home. I don't think I had a home group, per se, because I didn't know what the difference between what a home group and a meeting was. I just had meetings that I went to at that time. And I was going to Skyland a lot. I went back to Skyland, and there was a guy there who I hated. And you know why I hated him? Everywhere he went, he had his big book under his arm. And he was always talking about the steps and the traditions and God and amends. Oh my God, he loved to talk about amends. He loved to talk about how he hated his father and he'd almost killed him one time in a fist fight that they had, and how when he was dying of cancer, had made amends with him. They were good. And he got up in the bed with him while he was dying of cancer and held his hand and said it was okay to go, Dad. And I hated my father. Oh, did I hate my father still. And he was a Marine too, by the way, this guy. So I figured you might have some insights for me. And I asked him to be my sponsor. And within just really in a few months, we'd gone through the 12 steps. We started almost like, I think it was the next weekend, we started meeting together once a week. And then once a week, we would sit in his sponsor's basement. And his sponsor was Dennis Sanfilippo, who passed away in 2004 and has gone to the great meeting in the sky. And we sat in his basement and listened to the Joe and Charlie tapes. And then we would read the big book right up to wherever they had just stopped. Then we'd stop the tapes and read the book, and stop the tapes, go through and do the steps. And it was really powerful, and it was transformational. And within a very short period of time, I was back to being in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was back to just my goofy, natural, you know, weird, boisterous self. And I was happy again, and I wasn't thinking about blowing my brains out anymore. It's amazing to me. It's actually amazing to me how little effort this actually takes versus how much I have to think about doing something before I'll get off my ass and do it. You know? Everyone who's ever done a fourth and fifth step talks about it from this place of hope and this experience of change, that there's nothing but great. And everyone who hasn't done one yet talks about it from this place of fear. You know? And I was no different. You know? So if you haven't done a fourth and a fifth step with a competent sponsor, please get one and do that and just see what happens. Because I mean, AA has saved my life. Every single good thing in my life is from Alcoholics Anonymous. Every single one. And I almost missed it. I mean, as close as you can come, man, to missing it and not miss it. So anyway, I jumped in again with both feet in Alcoholics Anonymous. But now I had a purpose. And now I had a means to help the next guy. And now I had a program of action that I could agree upon with the people in my little circles. And we were doing this thing together. And things just started rocking and rolling. Some of y'all heard Kathy and I were doing the traditions workshop today, talk about how we met. And Kathy ended up coming into my life, and we ended up moving in together and getting engaged. So one day I got a phone call from Yale University saying, hey, would you like to come to school here? And I had applied to graduate programs a bunch of different places, and it was kind of like past the deadline. And I think that they didn't have exactly the right socioeconomic breakdown that they wanted in their group. And they didn't realize that I was an outsider. Here's an interesting thing. Is when you're applying to graduate schools, they don't give a crap about your high school. They just want to see your college. So I don't think they knew that they had a high school dropout, junkie, alcoholic, scumbag, redneck from Florida. But that's what they got. But I got to go. My wife and I got to relocate, move to Connecticut, and got to spend a few years up there going to graduate school at Yale University with all these really amazing people. You wouldn't believe some of the people God put on this earth. It's unbelievable. And then another opportunity came up, and we got to move from Connecticut to London, England for 4 years. And so we had a little baby, and we almost didn't move because we had this little baby. And we're like, I don't know, the healthcare is different, and blah, 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 blah. And then finally we're like, we'd be stupid not to move to England for 4 years. When we're lying on our deathbeds, we'll wish we'd have moved to England. So we moved to England. By the way, we got to Connecticut. We felt like they didn't do AA right up there. Anybody here from away and moved here and then decided they didn't do AA right here? We all have that experience. It's just alcoholic judgment. But they really didn't do it right. So we got involved starting an AA group there. And we jumped in with a bunch of people who also wanted to start an AA group there. They were from there, but they also thought they did it right there. And we were like, yeah, you're right. But we got this group started there and spent 3 years kind of building this little group. And we got one of the things we did there was the group had a couple meetings a week, but we also sponsored a meeting inside an institution down the street from there. And that meeting, it's amazing to me, and I've seen this now several times, when an AA group start sponsoring a meeting at a detox or a treatment center or a prison or a jail in their community, the people in those institutions, when they get exposed to really enthusiastic, strong AA in that way, when they come out, they don't want to just go to regular AA. They want to go to that group that had all that enthusiasm because they want to go back into that institution or wherever they came from. And so anyway, that group exploded in Connecticut, and we had to move to England. We moved to England for 4 years, had a second kid. Living in England, finishing up my graduate school, and the AA sucked there. Can you believe it? And so we started a group over there, and that group is still going, even though we started in our living room, and we had a little big book study in our living room. And about 6 months before we moved out, we moved it out to a little church down the street. And that is the primary purpose group of Nottingham. Yes, quite. And it's really crazy. They drink tea in AA. They drink tea. They don't drink coffee. They drink tea. They have a person who walks around. Tea commitment. Take a tea commitment. Yeah. They walk around with a big, what I would call a watering can, right? But they have a big teapot with a big schnozzle on it. And they walk around during the meeting. More tea. More tea. More tea. It's just right, while people are talking, just right through the whole meeting. It's really true. Anyway, we had coffee at our meeting, though. So. But what a crazy experience for some crazy, insane person like me to be able to have. And there's a lot more I could tell you about that. And then we came back to the States in 2003 or 2002, and we bought our first house in 2003. And finally, we were back to where they no longer did AA right. Because I'd been living away for 7 years, and we got back here, and you know what we thought? We thought, they don't do AA right here. Anyway, we got back here, set up shop, and we just had an amazing series of experiences. But we got back home, and we always wanted a little girl. We had two little boys, and so we were trying to have a girl, and you know, had one miscarriage, and but we were still trying to have a girl, Got pregnant. Yeah! Went to the hospital one day, and they were doing little scan things. It's a girl. Ha-ha! You know, so two little boys, and then a four-year gap, a little girl, and isn't that just perfect? Isn't that just the happy ending that you want? You know, you got the two boys and the girl and the house in the suburbs and the American dream and the alcoholic dream, and everything is great. And when Kathy was about 9 months pregnant, we went to the hospital for like a last scan before they were going to induce her, because she was going to basically be late. And she was always late. That she's been late to everything I've ever known her to go to. And and she will back me up on that. they did the little scan and everything, and they said, hey, listen, there's some kind of problem with your baby's brain, and we're going to have to send you over on an emergency basis to do a C-section right now. Go downstairs and drive to the hospital. And we drove to the hospital, and I called my sponsor. She called her sponsor. I don't think we got either one. I think we had to leave voicemails. This is the early days of cell phones, too. You know, it's like not a smartphone, just like a little flip phone. And then just as we were going into surgery, I got a call from my sponsor's wife. Said, what's going on with the baby? And I told her what was going on, and my voice broke, and I just started crying. And, you know, it was every parent's nightmare, you know. Anyway, a little girl was born. She had had a stroke in the womb for unknown reasons. And they never were able to satisfactorily tell us. She said, it's one of those things, man, we're really sorry. You know, and Kathy, because of the C-section, was in the hospital and couldn't be moved. And then the baby was in the emergency hospital across the street, you know, because she had to have scans and this and that done. So I was going back and forth between them. And like 10,000 members of Alcoholics Anonymous showed up in every possible way for us. And Al-Anons, I want to not forget to mention the Al-Anons, because Al-Anons know no matter what's going on, casseroles will fix it. Matter of fact, it was about 3 or 4 years later that we were cleaning out the basement. We have a chest freezer, or had a chest freezer down there, and I had to throw out the last of the Al-Anon casseroles that we had not gotten around to heating up and eating. They probably would have still been good, but we just had to clear them out. But anyway, people came and helped us out, and they showed up for us when we couldn't show up for ourselves. And, I mean, literally, Kathy's in the hospital, and I got these two little boys, and then my daughter's in the other hospital, and people came and said, what do you need? I said, I don't know. I can't think. And they said, your grass looks like it needs cutting. Yeah, okay, great. Cut the grass. Can I cut your grass? Sure. People cut the grass and hedged the lawn, trimmed the place. And the gals came over and they swept and they did the laundry. It's really, not, you know, I'm shedding a few tears about this, but the truth is they're happy tears, because that's, I'm so blessed. We've been so blessed in this whole deal. And my little girl had... she had a pretty profound brain injury. She required brain surgery, and a little down the road, and some more stuff. And the worst part, this is the thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, is it rains on the just and the unjust. You ever heard that expression? Mm-hmm. And there ain't no rhyme or reason to it. I don't think it has anything to do with God's will, right? I'm not one of those that believes that. I'm one that believes that it don't matter what the hell comes down the pipeline. If you do what you're supposed to do and you get right with the Spirit, man, you'll have the strength to deal with it. And so that's what happened. So my little girl, you know, she's, by the way, she's fine today. Amen. By the way, she's fine. She really is. She's up. I sometimes forget to mention that because I just get on the tangent. So goofy. I mean, she has some impairments and stuff, and she kind of looks a little bit like an autistic kid, but she's loving. I get a lot of I love yous from my kid. You know, I get a lot of, you know, Happy Father's Day, Daddy, you know, and that kind of stuff. So, but at first, the doctor, they'd done the surgeries and this and that, and we said, well, look, she's had this stroke and she's had this brain injury. So how do we know what to expect? What's going to be? Is she going to be able to talk? Is she going to be able to walk? Is she going to be able to see? Is she going to be able to hear? You know, all the kind of things a parent wants to know about their little infant child. And the doctor said, man, when a baby has a brain injury, there is just no way to know. If it was an adult, I could tell you this person's going to need speech therapy, and they're going to need this, and they're going to need that, but I can't tell you because this is an unformed brain, and you just don't know what's going to be impaired and what's not. Because you're just going to have to sit back and wait and watch and see. Now, is there any worse thing to tell an alcoholic that you're just, we can't tell you what's going to happen? I mean, but every time that my life has challenged me with something difficult, what I have learned is that if I will apply the 12 steps and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous to my life, I will get through it. And I have gotten through it. And I'm a better man for having gotten through it. And so we did. We got busy. We got through all that kind of stuff. And we moved on. Moved down the pipe. And it was a difficult, trying experience. But, you know, so, and then I lost my mother. Before my mother ever died, I lost her to an alcoholic. You know, just had her under his thumb because that's the kind of, you know, my mom was an Al-Anon. She likes them shiny drugs, you know. And that's what she always, you know, always did. She always went after drugs. And and that was a trying experience. But at every turn, I want to tell you how grateful I am for a good sponsorship. Because at every turn of my, every difficult time that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous, man, I have the best sponsors. And I've had the same sponsor now for the last 21 years. And it almost doesn't matter what I call him with. It's usually, have you written an inventory about this? Do you need to write an inventory about this? Or it's, how many sponsees do you have? You know? That's not enough, John. You know, you need to get out of the way. You need to get out of the way and let God do something to this situation. You need to take your hands off of it. Man, it's hard as hell to take your hands off of stuff, ain't it? It is so damn hard. But that's been really good advice for me. I sponsor an awful lot of guys today. I sponsor about 15, 16 guys. Some of them have been around a while, and they don't take a lot of my time. I've always got at least one or two or three new guys, though. And on Saturdays and Sundays at my house, we are in the book. We are reading these steps, and we are doing this deal, and we are getting involved in things. Now, since that time, you know, we got involved with a bunch of people starting a home group because, again, you know, we always sort of feel like we need something better, something more. And so we got involved with another dozen or so folks, and we started a group about 10. We just had our 10-year anniversary. It's a Fifth Tradition group. And it's a big old enthusiastic group. I love my home group. I mean, I really do think my home group is the best group in the world. And I really do believe everyone should feel that way about their home group. The home group, for me, is the heartbeat of my AA life. You know, I can't do anything about anybody else's group. You know, if someone's group's doing this or not doing that or they're not contributing enough or whatever, I can't do nothing about that. I don't care to do nothing about that. You know what I know? Because I sit in my group's business meeting every month. I know we're contributing money to the area, to the zone, to the this and to that. And I know that we're carrying the message. We got 30 commitments a week. We go to two different correctional facilities, a couple of different treatment center, sober living type places. We carry meetings to them drunks, man. And a lot of them drunks, when they get out of those places, they just come right over to the Fifth Tradition group, you know. And they don't ever go to just sit around AA, you know. I can't do just sit around AA. You know, I want to jump up and get in the middle of this thing AA. And it fires me up, man. I mean, I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous, like, the way I started my talk is just my truth, you know. Every good thing in my life, every single thing is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I am an alcoholic, insane scumbag. That's what I am. I'm just as sorry as hell on my own power. And since I came in here and I surrendered and I became teachable from a sponsor and I became guidable from a power greater than myself, man, I've just got this amazing life. It is unbelievable what's happened to my life, you know. And I shouldn't be here, you know. I shouldn't have all these blessings and gifts and amazing things that have happened to me in my life. I'll tell you something totally crazy. I will turn 50 on July 23rd. That's crazy. That is crazy. I was 19 when I got here. I'm retiring permanently on July 19th. How about that? That's some crazy shit right there. How is it possible? You know? That is some crazy, crazy stuff right there, isn't it? But God has blessed me so very much. you know. And all this really means is I'll be able to double down on my AA work, you know, double down about five times. But it's a progressive illness. I need to keep doubling down because my disease is sure as hell doubling down, you know. And I need to do more work over time, not less, you know. So I think that's all the time I got. I want to thank you guys all so much for having me out here and for listening so politely.
Great job, John. Thank you.